Welcome to this latest podcast from 5RB, Barristers' Chambers, specialising in media and communications law. In this edition, the first of two, we're going to discuss how to seek and defend an interim injunction application from the start up to the hearing. In the next edition, we'll explore what happens at the hearing and beyond. I'm Desmond Brown, and to explore the issues, I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Alexandra Marzek and Adam Speaker. In our area, interim injunction applications are obviously an extremely important part of our work. The injunction for the claimant is a very valuable weapon, but they are also sensitive, technical, and on occasions, so-called super injunctions, highly controversial. The law values freedom of expression highly and is particularly concerned to ensure that no prior restraints are imposed on speech, particularly speech in the media, unless it's strictly necessary. So far as the law of libel is concerned, the rule against prior restraint, or the rule in Bonnard and Perriman as it's often called, is very familiar. Going back to late Victorian times, it's prohibited the grant of an interim injunction for hundreds of years, other than in truly exceptional circumstances where there really is no defence. Where the speech to be prohibited is said to be private, confidential, or harassing, the approach for claimants is a little easier. But it's still tougher than in cases where the courts are required to look at prohibiting acts, not speech. In cases involving acts, the test is contained in the well-known case of American Cyanamid. In speech cases, the test is in Section 12 of the Human Rights Act, and the court has to balance the right to respect for private life under Article 8 of the Convention with the right to freedom of expression under Article 10. Now, Alex, you're sitting in chambers on a Friday afternoon wondering which train you're going to get out of Waterloo, when a call from a solicitor is put through to you. The solicitor tells you that she's been rung by the agent of a well-known TV presenter, let's call her Karen. She's been called because a press photographer was taking photos of Karen while she was walking in a local park earlier that day. That wouldn't be unusual, except that on this occasion, Karen was with her young daughter in a buggy, and also with her new boyfriend. Karen is separated from her husband, but still married. A reporter from one of the nationals has called the agent and told him that they are planning to publish a story based on Karen's new love affair. The agent assumes that the story is based on the pictures taken in the park that day. The solicitor also tells you that she's not spoken to Karen at this stage, just to her agent. Now, Alex, the solicitor wants to know whether the story and the photos can be stopped.
Well, first, I'd want to know what the real concern is. Is Karen worried about her privacy, or her child's privacy, or perhaps her new boyfriend's? Or is her real concern possible reputational damage? It's absolutely crucial to know from the outset what the real concern of the client might be.
I agree with that. The fact that it is an agent who's communicating with a solicitor rings alarm bells. It's fairly common these days, but it may mean that the true concerns of the client are not heard. If at all possible, I would want to meet the client as soon as possible to know what particular information she was looking to stop getting into the newspaper.
If Karen's real concern is to do with possible publicity attaching to the relationship, then I'd want to know what the relationship was. Are they in an intimate relationship or are they just friends? How long have they been together? Who knows they're together? Have they been out in public? Are they intending to go out in public at some point? I'd also want to know what the ages of the daughter and any other children are and the possible impact on them, if any.
Why, to pose an obvious question, do you want to know information of that kind? For example, the age of the child.
Because to obtain an interim injunction, there must be a cause of action. Now, the obvious cause of action here is misuse of private information. That requires an applicant to show that she had a reasonable expectation of privacy in respect of the information that she seeks to protect.
That's an objective test, as explained in Murray and Express newspapers, the J.K. Rowling case. The Court of Appeal said that it is necessary to consider, and I'm quoting, the attributes of the claimant, the nature of the activity in which the claimant was engaged, the place at which it was happening, the nature and purpose of the intrusion, the absence of consent and whether it was known or could be inferred, the effect on the claimant, and the circumstances in which and the purposes for which the information came into the hands of the publisher. That checklist is a very useful starting point for a solicitor seeking to understand a client's complaint and to decide whether there's any merit in it.
It's also necessary, really at all stages, to think about and understand what the newspaper will say in response. The test on an interim application, which comes from Section 12(3) of the Human Rights Act and has been explained by the House of Lords in Cream Holdings and Banerjee, is whether the applicant is likely to succeed at trial. That requires looking ahead to a trial and considering not only the claimant's case, but what the defendant will say and might say at trial. It requires balancing the claimant's rights with those of the newspaper.
Does it make a difference that there are photographs and not just a story in words about Garen?
Certainly, the media matters. Photographs are considered to be particularly intrusive.
Even photographs taken in the street or at a public event?
Well, it all depends on the circumstances. The courts have upheld privacy complaints involving the publication of photographs of children in public places, where it has been held that they had a reasonable expectation of privacy and there was no countervailing reason to publish. Weller against Associated Newspapers is perhaps the best example.
The same applies in certain circumstances with adults. The publication of photographs of adults can give rise to a reasonable expectation of privacy if they reveal some private fact or aspects of the subject's life. For example, in the Naomi Campbell case, the House of Lords held that some of the photographs published were unlawful because they disclosed her attendance at Narcotics Anonymous.
Well, now let's presume that the story that is threatened is about Karen's relationship.
Well, we would be dealing with information about the bare fact of a possibly new relationship. That impacts upon Karen's private life, but not in an extremely intrusive way. We're not dealing with details of what has been going on in the bedroom. The courts have found that the bare fact of a possible new relationship can be protected as private, but it very much depends upon the circumstances. As Mr. Justice Tugendhat said in the Fred Goodwin case, it's rarely realistic to expect that the bare fact of their relationship will remain confidential between the two of them for a long or indefinite period. Moreover, the courts rarely allow an applicant to obtain a blanket ban on any communication about the fact of a relationship. Mr. Justice Eadie made that point in CCNAB when he said it would not be proportionate to stop the husband of a woman who was having an affair with a client talking to friends or to family or to a doctor or a counsellor, even if it was proportionate to prohibit him from speaking to the press. So from a practical point of view, you might ask, look, this may come out in the future anyway. It may be sooner than you'd like, but why spend the money and the time fighting a story of this kind? It may be better to manage it, to speak to a partner, children, get some PR advice, issue a statement and be done with it.
The client might say that publication would be highly intrusive, unfair to the children of the family, and may also have in mind that material these days stays on the internet till kingdom comes.
And that may all be right, and that's the judgment call. If you can stop something of this kind getting out, then it may be worth doing so. But decisions have to be made in a very short period of time. Interim injunction applications are expensive. They require a claim to be started, which must be seen through to some kind of completion, settlement, or trial. And they might fail, and then they can become bigger than the story itself. The story becomes, this is the story they tried to ban. The client might be told to reflect upon what happened to Ryan Giggs or John Terry.
Or Andrew Marr or Jeremy Clarkson. That said, let's assume the client decides she's going to go for it. She wants to stop any article about her new relationship and any photograph of the child. What does she do next?
Well, then the papers for an interim injunction application need to be prepared. If time permits, The following are needed: a witness statement or statements, a draft order, an application notice, a claim form, a skeleton argument, and an explanatory note. It makes sense to split the task between the team, the solicitor preparing the witness statement, counsel preparing the order and the skeleton argument. Any solicitor, any practitioner working on an injunction application in this area must familiarise him or herself with the practice guidance on interim non-disclosure orders, which can be found in the White Book and sets out pretty much all of the information required. The key texts are Rule 25 of the CPR, particularly the first five paragraphs of Practice Direction A, and Section 12 of the Human Rights Act.
From a practical point of view, the solicitor also needs to find a judge. Now, during office hours, that's very straightforward, but on the weekend or in the evenings, it can be very tricky. Our clerks can help with this. They know who to ring.
If time's short, are there any corners that you can cut with the preparation of documents?
Undertakings can be given to file an application notice and claim form after the hearing. In truly urgent cases, counsel can inform the court of the evidence of his or her client, and undertaking can be given to produce a witness statement after the hearing, but it should usually be possible to produce some form of witness statement. A draft order will always be required because the court must know what order it is being asked to make, and the defendant must know what it is being told not to do, and that order must be clear and specific.
Does the evidence have to come from the client? Couldn't it come from the agent?
No, it has to come from the client, really. It's a very bad idea for the evidence to come from anyone other than the client. This was one of the factors that led Mr. Justice Tugendhat to reject John Terry's application for an interim non-disclosure order. In YXB against TNO, Mr. Justice Warby said, and I'm quoting here, "Claimants are expected to speak for themselves unless there is some good reason why they cannot do so. Ordinarily, therefore, at every hearing at which an order for non-disclosure is sought, there should be evidence from the claimant. If the rights of any third parties, such as partners, are relied on, they too should ordinarily speak for themselves."
There are many clients, of course, who don't wish to let the other side know that they're going for an injunction. What would you say to the solicitor if she asks you whether notice to the other side is really needed?
I would say that notice was absolutely necessary in a case of this kind. There are requirements as to notice under Section 12.2 of the Human Rights Act and also in Part 25 of the CPR, and I can think of no arguments to justify going without some kind of notice in Karen's case against a media organisation. There are cases where it can be justified to seek an injunction without notice, but the evidence for why that might be must be cogent and the reasons compelling. I'm thinking about cases involving persons unknown or where there's a risk of tipping off, but this is not one of them. Moreover, it's important, I think, for a client to understand that it's often better for notice to be given. The duty of full and frank disclosure does not apply when notice is given, and the judge is more likely to reach a favourable decision, assuming the merits are on the applicant's side, if he or she has heard from a defendant.
What about third parties? Do they have to be notified?
That's a much trickier question. The law is that an applicant needs to put on notice anyone he or she knows has an existing interest in the information which is to be protected. This is covered in the practice guidance at paragraphs 18 to 28. But giving notice to third parties also means alerting them, potentially newspapers and broadcasters, who don't know the information, that it exists.
But aren't there safeguards an applicant can use then?
Yes, an applicant can require any non-party served with notice of the application to provide undertakings, to use the materials provided only for the purpose of the injunction. This is also set out in the practice guidance.
Now, in addition to the evidence dealing with the facts, you have to think about issues like anonymity and privacy of the hearing. What are the issues there?
You do, certainly. When drafting the order and the evidence, you have to give thought to whether you're going to seek any derogations from open justice and what evidence you will need to put forward to support those applications. The general rule is that hearings are in public, parties are named, but as the practice guidance explains, the courts are expected to adopt procedures to ensure that any ultimate vindication of Article 8, where it's engaged, is not undermined by the way in which the court has processed an interim application. So you do have to think quite carefully when drafting the order about whether you're going to seek a private hearing, whether you're going to seek the anonymisation of the parties, whether you're going to seek to ask the court to seal the court file, for instance.
The various derogations from justice are set out in the model order attached to the practice guidance. If the information is the bare fact of the relationship, I'd expect the courts to grant anonymity and hear the matter in private before giving a public judgment. The court might also redact some of the information, with it being available only to the parties.
I agree. As the leading case on the subject, JIH and Newsgroup Newspapers, explains, the public interest is usually better served by anonymising the parties and setting out more of the information than naming the parties and providing no or very limited information.
Now, there are some interim privacy injunction cases that don't need to be anonymised or heard in private. I'm thinking about cases relating to photographs, particularly the memorable one involving the gentleman who called himself Mr. Rock and Roll.
Well, yes, it very much depends on the facts. In those kind of cases, the information is pictorial. And in cases of that kind, the hearing can take place in public and orders can be made not to allow the public to have access to the pictures or to documents or witness statements that are put before the court.
It may be different in cases, say, involving revenge porn, where if the intimate photographs have already been published, it would be unfair to name the claimant or the defendant and allow people to be able to search online, for instance, for the name of the person in order to find the photographs. As Alex says, it depends very much on the facts.
Right. Well, then the documents have been prepared. A judge is lined up for the hearing. Counsel's been instructed. A leader may have been consulted. And the defendant's been notified that the claimant is going for an injunction. Before we get to discussing the hearing, what would be going on at the defendant's end?
Well, at the defendant's end, there's likely to be general annoyance that it has to deal with an application of this kind when what it is trying to do is get a newspaper published. But it will have to decide whether to defend the application. Does it want to do so now? Or does it want to give an undertaking not to publish until it has more time to consider the position? It will need to think about what evidence in opposition to the application can be gathered in a very short period of time, such as evidence of similar material about Karen in the public that may be in the public domain.
I think it must be the experience of all three of us that newspapers seldom give undertakings. They prefer to fight.
Well, yes, and that's because instructions will be coming from the editorial department, who want to get the story out there as soon as possible, and they fear getting scooped if there's any delay. But in some cases, the right course of action is to give an undertaking for a few days that allows the paper to focus on getting the edition out and then look to get good evidence on which to fight an application, rather than trying to rely on perhaps very rushed cutting searches.
Yeah, newspapers can be nervous that the applicant may go off to another newspaper and try to get a softer, more favourable version of the story published. That is a valid concern, and that is one of the factors that they take into account when they decide whether they're going to defend an application immediately or whether they're going to seek more time.
What sort of evidence or arguments do newspapers usually rely on?
Well, it's almost always evidence to try to cast doubt on the argument that an applicant has a reasonable expectation of privacy. And that's likely to include evidence that the information sought to be protected is already publicly available in the media. In this case, it could be evidence that Karen and her boyfriend have been appearing in public together as a couple. There might be evidence that shows a public interest in publishing. The general test is whether the subject matter contributes to a debate of general interest, such as to outweigh an individual's privacy rights. That might be because there are other individuals involved who want to tell their story, and therefore their Article 10 rights are engaged. In some cases, the newspaper might want to point to statements that Karen or another applicant might have made in the past, which can be said to present a false picture about them and requires to be corrected.
Now, putting right the record, correcting a false image, what does that involve?
Well, it involves comparing what Karen is complaining about in this case with her previous conduct on other occasions. It's been held to be in the public interest to be able to correct a false public image, but it must be one created by the applicant herself. And there's a long-running argument over whether sports stars and celebrities are role models and whether they should be held to higher standards than members of the public. This is an argument that waxes and wanes. Whether or not the famous should be held to higher standards is a sound argument. It's certainly the case that if someone has set herself up or himself up in a particular way, that image may in some circumstances be allowed to come crashing down. It reflects the concern, I think, that whilst true private information is often the subject of a privacy injunction, the public interest in the truth coming out is still an important consideration.
What other kind of arguments should the newspaper consider raising in their defence?
Well, we've been discussing the particular considerations applying to privacy injunctions, but of course the usual principles as to the discretionary jurisdiction to grant interim injunctions all apply. So a defendant newspaper will also need to consider whether it can defend an application on the basis that there is no real threat of publication, perhaps because the story they want to publish doesn't even feature the information that Karen's concerned about, or perhaps on the basis that Karen and her lawyers have dithered and they haven't acted promptly, or on the basis that the applicant hasn't given a truthful or candid account of events to the court, or because the threatened publication won't cause the claimant any harm which is serious enough to engage the jurisdiction of the court, which might be the case if the information is seen as trivial.
And in order for a defendant to make a decision about whether to and how to resist an application, and in order to advise a defendant of such, I'd want to see a copy of any draft story, including pictures, captions, headlines. It may well be that the draft order the claimant wants will not prevent publication of the proposed story at all. Or small amendments might be able to be made to the story to avoid the contentious material. From the draft story, you are able to see what the real point of importance to the media client is, what you need to fight for at the hearing, and what isn't important.
Well, that brings us to the hearing, and also to the end of the first part of our two-part podcast series on interim injunctions. In part two, we'll consider the hearing itself, and what happens if the application succeeds or fails.